Life coaching and discovery. Inspiration with an invitation to learn from a self-discovery guide. Mark is passionate about you making positive changes in your life so that it becomes a vibrant, ongoing journey of growth and discovery. Welcome to the Inspire Possibility Show. Now, here's your host, Mark Susnow.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Inspire Possibility Show. And I don't know why I'm calling it episode, but it's really a conversation, and it's really about inspiring possibility in our lives. And I started to think about, you know, where do these possibilities really show up in our life? It could be in terms of, let's just say, a dream we have. But what I'm really into today is really talking about a new attitude, a way of looking at life in a different way. I'm involved with an organization called the Hoffman Institute, and I received an email from one of his board members about a bicycle trip that he was on. And being that I, you know, used to be a mountain biker myself, and I used to read about Lance Armstrong, and I even read that book, It's Not About the Bike, I was intrigued about his trip, about his bicycle trip across the United States. And on the bottom there was a link on his email signature about the most dangerous four-letter word, and it was a TED talk he gave. And so I was curious about what that four-letter word was, and so I listened to the TED talk, and then I invited Dick Simon to be my guest today. And I think he has some really insightful and powerful things to share with us. And without telling you more about Dick, I'm just going to let him, in our conversation, let it kind of be revealed. So thanks, Dick, for being my guest on the Inspire Possibility Show.
Thanks so much, Mark. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Yes. And so what I've on your website, and by the way, you can find out more about Dick at DickSimon.com, but you travel around the world, and you spent time with people on all sides of conflicts and sharing their experience, and it says that you're what's interesting, I noticed on your website, with all these things you do, the first thing it says is photographer, speaker, change maker. So let's today talk about the change-making aspect of some of the work you did. So tell us now, probably our listeners are wanting to know, what is that most dangerous four-letter word?
All right, so the most dangerous four-letter word, and it's interesting, when I'll sometimes do talks in schools and things, the teachers will get very, very nervous at the time. Wait, most dangerous four-letter word, what am I going to hear from parents? The most dangerous four-letter word that I refer to is them, T-H-E-M. That word is used to marginalize. That word ends up creating wars, justifies slavery, creates genocide. That word creates the other. And once you have the other, you've dehumanized other human beings, and all bets are off. It also makes it a lot harder, even biologically, to be rational once you've defined other versus yourself. But we can get into more of that later.
Okay. So them, and then the other, more or less like us and them. More or less, kind of
exactly.
Like that. There's
exactly.
Us and there's
us and them. I'm here to protect my family, my group, my tribe, my whatever against the other, and it generates fear. And you know, at that point, you're conditioned as to how you react in a fear situation. The brain has a piece of it, the amygdala. Its job is to turn off the rational part of your brain and just get you out of there. Your fight or flight.
Right.
No longer rational thought, and that's how we end up living so much of our lives, unfortunately.
And it's more or less been this way through, you know, civilization. Back in the nomad tribes, they had their tribe, and they were protecting themselves from the other tribes, right?
Exactly.
Protecting their food, protecting their loved ones, and then it's today. I mean, it's continued to today how, you know, we see it in the political world, and I mean, I cannot believe the number of, you know, conversations out there where, you know, it's more or less been with politics and religion. You know, it's either it's our religion, their religion, or with politics, and to where we almost lump people together and feel we can't be friends with them because they have different beliefs than we do, and they're part of that them. You know, they're
right.
Those people
and
that
I wish
believe
it
this.
Were was yeah, and I wish it was almost, but unfortunately, in many situations, it actually is. Just this labeling that keeps us that has us making assumptions. I mean, you know, we can call them stereotypes, whatever, about the other that may or may not be true. But we're no longer open to information that is in contrast to the pre-established belief that we've created, which makes, you know, communication incredibly difficult, if not impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So I did this bikes. You had mentioned earlier the bicycle trip, and you know, is Know Them America. I mean, I come from the East Coast, from the Boston area, and, you know, I've spent a reasonable amount of time on the East Coast, on the West Coast, very little in the center of our country. And the idea was, let me, particularly in this year with all the political tensions and the like, I wanted to go out and explore America and really see the other. And sure enough, in rural small towns, all over the Northwest, we're out the Great Plains. I was in bars or diners or whatever, engaging in conversations with people who have very different backgrounds and certainly current life experiences than I do, and yet have their own perspectives on things. And, you know, political parties in general, and certainly, you know, in this election year, can be extremely polarizing. And yet when you get behind that and begin to see the other as just another human being with potentially a different perspective on things, the whole game changes. So that was the intent, and that's pretty well what came out of
it. Wow. So what? So how many miles was this trip?
Just about 4,000.
So you
on
your bicycle?
The northern portion. I'm sorry?
So what kind of bicycle did you have?
It's called a touring bicycle. It's sort of a balance of being light enough and fast enough, but durable. Because, you know,
so it was
for
more
a trip
or less
that
like
length,
a hybrid, maybe between a mountain bike and a road bike, kind of.
Yeah, it's hybrid is a little bit different because it's built with some other criteria. But many of the people doing sort of cross country rides do it on something called a touring bike, which balances comfort a little bit more, ability to carry weight, some things that, you know, just become considerations on long distance rides.
So,
but it
so
was a 4,000 mile trip. Oh, go ahead. A 4,000 mile trip over a 3-month period, and. You know, I would go on average 65 miles a day. Was mostly staying in motels as I went. And the purpose was to meet people and see parts of the country that I'd never really been exposed to.
Uh-huh.
And it certainly worked.
Uh-huh. So what did you discover? I mean, what would you say that, you know, I guess you started to say that when you get to know people, that I guess getting to know someone is really – then they're no longer the other.
Right. And a lot of getting to know someone is just breaking down that barrier that keeps you from knowing them. I mean, you know, someone you spend a few hours with is not, you don't know everything about them. They're not your deep, long-time, lifelong friend.
Right.
But you're able to have a real conversation if you can get past the barriers. And so I spent a lot of this summer doing exactly that. You know,
right.
You would meet someone. I stayed away from politics. I was open to them sharing whatever they thought, but, you know, I wasn't there to debate or try to convince somebody that I was right and they were wrong. And once you get past, we have sort of a view that the other politically or religiously or whatever is just wrong and is a whole package of they are wrong because of X, Y, Z, actually frequently goes A through Z. And once you get to know them, I mean, there may certainly be areas of some disagreement, but it's no longer this broad characterization of not understanding at all what they may be about. And, you know, the beauty of this trip was the opportunity to do that. And it builds on, over the last last 14, 15 years since September 11th, 2001, I've been working through an organization called YPO that's 23,000 international CEOs in 130 countries. And what I've been doing is, on a volunteer basis, I've been chairing an initiative there that we call the Peace Action Network to get members who are on opposite sides of geopolitical conflicts in the Middle East and India, Pakistan, you know, in this country, potentially religious conflicts, together meeting in intimate settings where they can get past these differences and walk in the other shoes, which is actually an exercise that we use, to really be able to see the other as other human beings. And then there may be some, you know, disagreement on policy. But disagreement on policy can be resolved. Disagreement, you're a bad human being and everything is your fault, and I'm a good human being, and if you were just me, like me, we'd be okay. That doesn't allow a lot of room for talk.
Right. So I'm curious about some of the actual experiences you've had, you know, where you've helped bridge these gaps in terms of getting to know them or to getting them to, you know, like some really hotbed conflicts. How have you really worked with people from different countries to in this? And I believe, I don't know if you said this, but I read in your materials, it's really what it is. It's a peace action network. I saw on your website. And how do you actually integrate that, or what are like some actual examples of that? And you've been doing this now for what, 13, 14? You're saying this started after 2001?
Right. After September 11th, a few of us said, this is crazy. This international organization, YPO, that we're members of, has members on opposite, you know, in 130 countries on opposite sides of basically almost every geopolitical or regional conflict out there. How do we get those members talking to each other? Because otherwise what would have happened would be if you'd be at a large international event and there might be an Israeli and a Saudi or something, they do all they could to avoid each other. If they couldn't, you get a polite hello, and then instantly someone would go to the bar or the bathroom or whatever to get out of the situation. And we tried to break down that paradigm by creating these confidential, intimate groups that could really, really get to know each other, so that it was no longer just each being a cardboard, you know, like a cartoon cutout almost of the other.
So how many people, like, so give me an example. So you would say you would create these confidential groups. Like, give me an example of just, say, you know, different geopolitical interests. Like, where would the groups be from, and how many people would participate?
Yeah, so I can share. Some of it is because of confidentiality, you know, that helps make it work. But one that I'm happy to share, because it's now very public, is India and Pakistan. Now, India and Pakistan are both two nuclear-armed powers, and almost since their independence, there have been ongoing skirmishes or wars between them. It's ratcheted up now a lot because both of them have nuclear weapons. So in 2003, where there had been no diplomatic relations between India and Pakistan for 3 years because of some incidents, we created a forum that met several times in Dubai, because at that point Indians were not allowed to go to Pakistan and Pakistanis weren't allowed to go to India. This forum, after several meetings, kind of got it that, you know, they might have different political opinions, but, you know, it would be better for everyone if this conflict didn't exist as an ongoing conflict and potential nuclear annihilation of their countries with who knows what effect in the rest of the world.
Right.
So the Pakistanis arranged to invite 133 of the members of this YPO organization, who represent a lot of the top businesses in India, to Pakistan. And in the course of that meeting with the then president of Pakistan, they spent 3.5 days there. And in the course of that meeting, the Prime Minister, the then President of Pakistan, Pervez Musharraf, announced that he would reopen Pakistani airspace for the first time in 3 years to India, to flights from India. And within a month and a half, he and the Indian Prime Minister were meeting for the first time in 3 years. So we didn't totally cause it, but we sure helped catalyze and move it forward. So that's an example. And it was kind of interesting, of the group going over, everyone other than those who had been in forum, which was a total of 15 people, like I think it was 8 Indians and 8 Pakistanis, other than that group, everyone else was there because this was going to be a really interesting trip to Pakistan, which all the Indians viewed as a terrorist hellhole, but there would be a lot of security and they would be invited by Pakistan's top business leader, so it would be safe enough to see this forbidden land. That's how people walked into it. By the end, the Indians and the Pakistanis both were saying, you know, we're the same. We look the same. We speak a common language.
Right.
You can't tell us apart. You know, yes, you, and hands get pointed both ways, you know, are wrong on this issue and that issue in Kashmir, but those are like problems to be worked out. And I think it was this sense that there were human beings on the other side that you could potentially work with that led to the head of state meeting. Because these, a lot of these people have relations with their head of state, and the Indians went back and told their then Prime Minister Vajpayee, you know, you should meet with Musharraf. He's like reasonable enough to cut a deal.
And, so has there been any when this was like 2003?
Correct. And there were a lot of ongoing activities since then.
Okay, that's what it was my next question. So there's like
follow-up. Oh, no, absolutely.
Yeah, and what about, has there been similar interventions in the Middle East, too, with YPO and the Peace Action Network?
Sure. So one group that we brought together and has been meeting now for like 13, 14 years are Arab and U.S. business leaders. So Arab business leaders from the Middle East, predominantly Muslim, but some Christian, who are, you know, from Egypt and Saudi and Jordan and, you know, throughout the region, meeting with U.S. counterparts, you know, from all over the states, who also are running, you know, significant businesses in the states. And that group, you know, first there was a period of mutual learning because each side always has its own narrative. I mean, that's what's so interesting. Everyone believes that their narrative is the narrative and doesn't even really realize that there are multiple stories, which is always so eye-opening. It isn't as though I'm right, you're wrong. It's I'm right, and there really is no other story. And then you understand that the other side feels like they're right, and they don't understand that there's another story. So moving beyond that, this group then got very, very involved in entrepreneurship in the Middle East, where if 100 million jobs aren't created over the next decade, even less than a decade, the problems there that we're seeing now are just, you know, the future is in the kids, and these are entrepreneurial efforts to foster job and company growth with young Arab entrepreneurs. And that's
I'm sure you're familiar with, is it Marshall Rosenberg that wrote Nonviolent Communication?
Yeah, I know. Yes.
Yeah. So there's been a lot of conflict resolution. Does your group get involved in the conflict resolution aspect of it too?
To a certain degree.
Like,
I mean, yes, you're using different sets of tools, but yes. Yes. We do one exercise that I'd be happy to share that we call In the Other Shoes. And basically what you're doing is you're listening and then repeating back in the first person what you've just heard from the other side, if you will. So just try to imagine, you know, you're in a forum meeting or meeting like this with, you know, a dozen or so Israeli and Palestinian members. And an Israeli had just shared what had happened to him and his family, and the Palestinian then repeats back something like, you know, I came out of a cafe in Tel Aviv and heard a loud explosion, and my brother-in-law's blood and body parts were all over the street. At that point, the Israeli knows they've really been heard, and just by saying it, the Palestinian feels it to a certain degree, and it creates a certain amount of empathy, and a freedom fighter all of a sudden killed his friend's brother-in-law. and then flip it around, that the Israeli might then share, you know, the middle of the night, and the soldiers stormed into our house, screamed at us, humiliated me in front of my family, locked us up in a room, and we'd done nothing wrong. And then all of a sudden, you know, and remember, this is an Israeli saying, what he had just heard from the Palestinian, then all of a sudden, you know, a necessary security incursion has a lot more human cost. And it's just a way of humanizing all this conflict once you've established enough of a bond that people have walked in the other shoes and can feel a connection. And then you build on that.
Right. So what's next for you? What's next for Dick Simon?
Great question. One that I was doing a lot of thinking about as I pedaled across the United States. I'm doing, you know, this message, I believe, and you really see it, you know, in our country right now in this election season, where you're seeing increasing polarization, both politically, religiously, you know, all the divides just keep building. So what's next for me is really to continue in this work and expand and scale it, both, you know, with business leaders and working with others. I do a lot of speaking. I'm involved in writing. You had mentioned photography, you know, a lot of exhibitions, sort of humanizing the other. And a lot of work supporting and helping organizations that do good work to grow and scale. Because my original background, you know, for my business career, if you will, was, you know, included growing a high-tech company and a lot of real estate investment development activities. And at one point, there was international trade, too. So helping, you know, there's a certain entrepreneurial skill set that maybe I was born with and then certainly, you know, I honed over the years. And to the extent
right.
that and strategy can be helpful, I spend a lot of time doing that.
You know, there's one thing I didn't mention that I thought was kind of unique is every once in a while, I mean, I like to make up words, and you made up the word themification to talk about this, the other, this whole concept of that we talked about in the beginning. I love that word, themification. And another thing I know we talked offline was, off air, was this acronym you had for worry. Just something that I loved it, and I wrote it down, and I've memorized it, and I want to share this with the listeners because I know that so often we worry obsessively, and what my understanding of your acronym is wasted obsessive ruminations that ruin your life.
Or ruining you, yeah.
Ruining yeah. you, yes. It's a great one, and
I mean, we get captured.
You know,
I was just going to say that
I think it captures
we,
them also in terms of other people. Is that we, you know?
Oh,
we,
absolutely.
We
the number of things
yeah.
that we waste time worrying about, you know, or we were also talking earlier about fear. You know, I use it as false expectations appearing real, where we just sort of live in that world, and then we just look for data that supports it. I mean, psychologists call that confirmation mm-hmm. bias, where we only mm-hmm. seek, see, and hear what we expect and really want to hear to make us comfortable with whatever position we have or have taken.
Mm-hmm. So then you're going to be, so you've done the bicycle trip and you want to continue this work with the getting the word around other organizations and businesses around this idea of coming together, of working together. What do you have any, you did the bicycle thing. What is there like, are there any publications you've written along these lines that people can get a hold of? Any articles you've
sure.
written?
Sure. Yeah, a number of them appear on my website, dicksimon.com. A number of them are in the Huffington Post, and, you know, others keep coming. And I keep giving talks and things like that. I've led delegations to three different delegations to Iran, to North Korea, to Cuba, to places that, you know, we think we know everything about, but we tend to see them just through the filter of, you know, of evil. And not to say that there aren't a lot of bad things in a mm-hmm. lot of places, but I think when we have a complete monolithic view of any place, we're just missing out. I mean, you go to Iran, where you start talking with the young people in Iran, and they're like talking with the young people anywhere. Now, that's not to justify any of the political issues at all, but it's just that's another dimension. I was at a conference a little while ago in Cairo that brought together 3,000 young tech entrepreneurs from the Arab world. It was exactly like going to a comparable conference in Silicon Valley, except the language was different. Exactly. No one wanted to talk about politics or ISIS or whatever. They were there to convince you why their product was better than Kayak or Facebook or whoever they were targeting, or why they were really going to solve the online marketplace issue by doing X. It was great. But here's what really concerned me. So 3,000 young people, a lot of the future of entrepreneurship, or some of the future of the tech entrepreneurship, certainly, in the Middle East, gathered one place, a really wonderful conference. There were zero Western media covering it. It wasn't an ISIS story. And that week, all that was being sought were ISIS stories to reconfirm why we had to be afraid and how the Middle East is being defined. There's a great book that I would recommend to everyone, Chris Schroeder, Startup Rising. It just talks about how we have this monolithic view of the region, but here's what's really going on other dimensions. Here's what the startup world there looks like. And it's very, very dynamic, and it's mostly driven by young people. And that's really the future of the Middle East. I mean, there's there's still political issues and conflicts and the like to be dealt with, but ultimately it's the youth that will represent what happens there in the future.
But all, like you say, all we hear about in the media are these bombings and all this kind of stuff, and it is kind of disheartening because it's I talk about how bad news sells, and with all the media, Mac Mail, and every time I get an email, it shows up on my laptop, my iPad, everything, and I get it like three different places instead of once, right? And it's just inundated. And that is a problem. But it sounds encouraging. What is encouraging is that you give a very you're sharing a vision that you find that can really. This vision of entrepreneurship, of working together, of innovation, is really a way that is very happening in the Middle East, which people don't hear about. And if more people work together and become leaders, then there's hope for world peace, and which is the work you're doing. Well, I want to thank you for being my guest on the Inspire Possibility Show. You've given us
thank
a lot
you.
Of insight. And I want to also thank you for your and not just thank you but acknowledge you for your courage for reaching out and going into these areas that are full of conflict potentially, and being willing to be curious and to want to make a difference. And what I get from our conversation is that you're committed to making a difference so that we have a better world. And so I want to acknowledge you for that, because I know how important that is for all of us. And so thank you again for being the guest on the Inspire Possibility Show.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And I want to say to our listeners, tune in. Again, next week we're going to have another insightful guest and somebody to inspire us. And in the meantime, journey on until next time. Talk to you then.
You've been listening to Inspire Possibility Show with Mark Susnow. To learn more about Mark Susnow, go to inspirepossibility.com and click on the contact button. Schedule a complimentary visit with Mark or email him at mark@inspirepossibility.com. Imagine. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine. Imagine. Imagine the possibilities. Imagine. Imagine the possibilities.